You're listening to the Theater of Public Policy podcast, and my name is Brandon Boat. The show you're listening to now featured former Minnesota Supreme Court Justice Paul Anderson, who had quite a strong career of public service in a variety of different sectors, serving with the original VISTA program signed in by JFK that later became the AmeriCorps program. He also dipped his toe into the water of politics a few times, working on a campaign for former Governor Arne Carlson, and eventually reaching his way to the Minnesota Supreme Court, where he oversaw a number of different landmark cases and wrote the opinions that have shaped countless number of other decisions. I hope you enjoyed the show. He was a lot of fun.
I will not turn my back on the actor. And I will not sit on the stage having a beer in front of me.
Okay. Sorry.
So that's yours. No, you can. It's all right
for
you.
I could finish it really quickly.
No, you, please, okay, keep
okay,
it there.
Okay, thank you. Well, thank you so
much. I have standards, you know. Yeah. Oh, no, that not, went out the window when I agreed to a
yeah,
beer.
Yeah, apparently not. I mean, look at how far you've come. So we're so honored to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us. So, you had a very long career, and I wanted to...
I'm old. Yeah, that's right.
In the judicial... I didn't say that.
You implied it.
Okay. So, you're very good at hearing things that are arguments.
I've
so,
got a lot of practice.
Yeah. You were on the Supreme Court for 19 years. Before that, you're on the appellate court. And before that, you had a life to some degree in politics as well, correct? Or in the...
Marginally. See, marginally. I never fit.
You never fit. So, well, I mean,
I was too modern. I'll explain my politics for the folks. It's the John Prine song, Grandpa Was a Carpenter. And it says, Grandpa was a carpenter. He built buildings, houses, churches, and schools, leveled doors on the level, wore church clothes every day. And he voted for Eisenhower because Lincoln won the war. See, my family goes back to the 1850s in Minnesota.
Oh, wow.
And so it's the Lincoln Republican tradition. And so you sometimes affiliate because of, well, Lincoln won the war.
Lincoln won that's a long time to hold an idol. That's good. I mean, you think.
Well, he did, he did 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment. You know?
Yeah, those were good ones. I'm supportive of those amendments in particular.
You remember those.
Right? I do. I don't remember when they were passed, as some people. Never mind. So you were appointed to the court in the early 90s, and I'm wondering what changed over that time, potentially, from then to, over the 19 years that you were there?
Minnesota has always had a centralist, a center-moderate, you could say center-left, center-right, and I came onto a court that was more left, center-left. I saw over the period of time is that the court kind of drifted more to the right. And so when I left the court, to many people's surprise, some people said I was the most liberal member of the court. I had, but they didn't know my background. See, I was in my idols. I see one of the people in your audience wrote about them. The John Pillsbury, the Stassen, Youngdahl, this Minnesota tradition of progressive populism. I'm going to get up on the pulpit, okay?
Okay. I love this. I'm going to take the night off.
I believe in the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness that Jefferson wrote about. And see, pursuit of happiness is a theory of government. See, and that's why government can't guarantee that people are going to be happy. But government has an absolute obligation to provide the maximum opportunity for the maximum number of people to achieve happiness. See, that's what this country is about. And that's why the people that are going to want to drown governments to size you can drown in the bathtub, they're almost unpatriotic when you go back to the premise that the founding fathers were talking about why we are. It's a theory of government, and I believe that.
Do you talk... That was good.
A little too patriotic?
No, it's still. I guess my question, as this cynical young person that I've become, is
never be cynical. Skeptical, yes, but don't make the mistake of going over the side and being cynical. Cynics, we got a lot of cynics in the media and whatever, and is it why they're so bad? They want to turn people off. They want to make their opponent appear so bad, and then is it the they just don't say, I'm going to pox on both houses. You get people who don't trust politicians, they don't trust politics. Skeptical, yes. Oh, my gosh. That's what I live the life of, being skeptical. But I never, never will let myself go over the edge and be cynical, because that, again, does not make a civil society work. So, I mean, those are some of the guiding principles that I would follow. So, I know you. You're skeptical. But you're not, in no way are you cynical.
That's good. You know me better than I know myself, perhaps. I mean, the question I was going to ask is, you talk about this long tradition in Minnesota of progressive populist politics. Do you feel like that's changing or has changed?
Yes, it's changed some. And, now you're going to get me into the – it's the polarization. And politically, I've probably not been as concerned about our country as I am now, is that – well, Al Quie is going to be recognized in honor. I mean, he's a conservative Republican, mm-hmm. whatever. And I talked to Al about this. I said, you know, where do we fall in the political spectrum? He said, well, you know, when he was in Congress, he was on about the 35-yard line conservative. Carl Perkins, his compatriot in the Democratic Party, 35-yard. There's a lot of common yardage that they had and a lot they could agree on. I said, well, now, Al, it seems like a lot of people are, you know, around the 10 or 20-yard line. He says, no, a lot of them are in the end zone. And so when you get this sharp polarization, there's not any middle ground to agree on policy for the better good and the common will. So it all becomes about power. Disable my opponent so I have power. Same way. And so that's how politics can be so nasty and sort of vicious, because it's not how you disagree on what is the best policy. Is it, I mean, I can't work with somebody, so I'm going to defeat them so I can do what I want. Both sides are guilty of some of the similar strategy on this.
I wonder if there's a sense, and I feel like I hear both sides of this to some degree, about whether the court has been outside of that to some degree, where it hasn't been the source of some of those political divisions, or at least that's the way we think about it, and whether that's right or not, I guess.
Surely that's true in Minnesota. We've dodged the bullet so far. I mean, we disagree. Some critics will try and make it political. There was an editorial in May that touched on that, and I thought it was wrong. It was just a disagreement in judicial philosophy. Both are valid. But some states, it gets quite tense and vicious. Wisconsin, right across the border. I mean, big money coming into the judicial elections. Seeing that, again, it's not where the parties can come together. We're going to put our people in power, or put other people in power. That's the way you prevail. And it's not good for society to have that sharp division like that.
Well, I was going to ask about the whole electing of judges has always seemed a bit of a quandary to me, in the sense that what are folks, your regular citizens, voting on? And I worry sometimes maybe that we have elections for judges and the things that people are voting on are not maybe 95% of what judges actually do. They're voting on maybe one or two really hot button things that they hear about.
The hot button issues don't work for judges, but they get described that way. And so you energize votes. I mean, I've heard comments even from one of your audience members about a judge candidate saying something that is obviously very political. That's wrong. You shouldn't do it. I mean, there are differences in judicial philosophy. There are differences in judicial temperament. There are differences in how people approach the law. Those are all legitimate. But to make it into a partisan fight, we don't have a whole lot of political issues that, you know, come before the court. We have some that you can divide that way. But no, you want a judge who's open-minded. You want a judge that has sufficient humility to entertain self-doubt. That's not indecisiveness. Self-doubt means that you are able to continually re-examine the issue so you can figure out if you're doing justice and the right thing. And you want a judge who will take the facts and take the law, juxtapose them, and come out with basically the law says. I mean, I had a clerk say that to me once. He said, you take the facts, take the law, put them together, and it drives the result. And then she added this comment, she says, and sometimes you're surprised where you come out, aren't you? But that's okay, because that's what we're supposed to do.
So we have an election coming up next week. I don't know, you might have heard.
Really?
Yes, I'll fill everyone in later.
Okay.
I guess the question is, what should we ask candidates for judgeships then to try and ferret some of that information out? What is the question to ask somebody to figure out if they fit that mold that you're talking about?
It's very hard. It's very hard. You should talk to people who know the candidates and ask them to describe the temperament, the approach, and the even-handedness, and if they'll be fair. See, these people will be judges, will be dealing issues that deal with life and liberty, and they'll be dealing with property, they'll be dealing with children, and you want to look and see, if I have a tough case and I have to go in front of this person, does this person have the type of temperament that I will be comfortable feeling going before them? And it's not partisan, it's not political, it's the person. You mentioned earlier, you said the majesty of the law.
Yes, that's one of your very famous lines, yeah.
Well, I mean, you've got to honor the law. See, this is what is that we had a couple of constitutional amendments a couple of years passed, and I wrote dissented on that, and I talked about the nature of fundamental law and ordinary law, and I talked about how important the Constitution is. I mean, it's like in Ulysses, when he was tied himself to the mast so that he could hear the siren song but would not bring his ship upon the rocks. We tie ourselves to a constitution. We change it reluctantly because we then can avoid the siren songs of what's popular and maybe not all that good of the present day, and we can remain grounded as a civil society. And somebody who respects the majesty of that tradition and history, that's the kind of person you want to serve on the court.
Can I just point out for the audience, we have never had a guest who has gone from constitutional law to Ulysses back to the sanctity of our voting process in answer.
I'll go to Tom, stop. I'm going to tell you. Okay, this is a story. I'm going to reveal too much. We got the Coleman-Franken race, and we're doing a dissent, and it's about voting, you know. And by the way, voting is bifurcated. Voting is speaking. That's when you vote. And is being heard, okay? And so I thought that the majority in a temporary order was making the wrong thing. And so one of my colleagues came down, who was also dissenting, said, I got this great quote from Joseph Stalin. It says, I don't care who votes as long as I get to count. Well, I'm not going to quote Joseph Stalin. So I found, not my clerk, it's me, there's Tom Stoppard, it's mm-hmm. Pretty right.
Yeah.
He says, it's not the voting that matters, it's the counting. And see, that comes into play. I mean, how a Secretary of State does his or her job and whatever. It's that fundamental, sacred right to participate. You know, you get in our society, you get to speak, and you should be heard.
We've talked a lot about the really a lot of the big things, but you kind of led me into wanting to talk about some of the interpersonal stuff. So what is it like? I mean, what's it like behind the curtain of the Supreme Court, I guess, is what I'm interested in. Is it that they
we've
just
got
like,
all kinds of ropes and pull things, and then
there's
a calliope and the whole.
You just said, like, one of your fellow justices, you know, just happened, like, by. My do they favorite, just knock on it like a dorm room
justices,
door?
One of my favorite justices. We're very collegial.
You are?
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, and I would work very hard on the collegiality.
Do you have, like, softball team that you're
We have court lunches quarterly. We spend a lot of time together because we're conferencing. And, I mean, very different personalities. I like to joke. I mean, I was known for always having my candy dish with nice exotic chocolate and whatever because I would draw people into my chamber and we would interact because that's what makes government work. You know, you got to communicate. And if I tweak somebody, if I thought they were, a little, I'd give them a little bit of a hard time, and they know I was having fun with them. But, I mean, no, we get along, and we work at it. I mean, but trust me, if it's going to work. And this is one of the things I don't like about some of the aspects of politics. People don't realize that you've got to work at getting along with you. Oh, now I'm going to really go on thin ice, okay?
Okay. That's good. That's
no, I'm
why we're here.
You know, I'm very much into history, okay? And mm-hmm. so I've been involved in the restoration of the Capitol. The building was literally falling down, okay? And by the way, it was the Republican-controlled Senate and House that created the committee for the restoration of the Capitol.
I remember, yeah.
So if we're going to restore the Capitol, we got to do it right. And just like the state of Wyoming, that conservative western state, which restoring their capital and built an addition to their legislative office building, we needed a place to put the senators to get them out of the Capitol. Okay, so we're building the legislative office building. The time is right. The time is now. But as they were designing the building, since I was on the committee that chose the design-build contract, I said, design that building so they have to interact with each other. Republicans and Democrats, they run into each other at the elevator. They have to park next to each other in the parking lot.
How do you do that? How does the design work? Do you just...
You follow Steve Jobs, figured it out with Pixar. I mean, Pixar was a failed company.
There's a lot of Democrats and Republicans there.
No, it's worse. It's worse. It's artists, technicians, and administrators.
Oh, God.
That's even worse. But he designed the complex so that they would have to interact. And, you know, Pixar is phenomenally successful in these movie production. The same way as, you know, if you want government to work, you don't design it so people are separated and they can fall back into their isolation. Force them to run into each other. I mean, that's, you know, I'm coming looping back to say what it's like behind the curtain at the court. We have to work with each other. I mean, that's, we will not function if we don't work. So we figure out how to do it.
So does it, this is getting to be another very political question, but does it worry you then, and we talked a little bit about this, that spending on judicial elections nationwide has just skyrocketed over the last decade? I think it's gone up tenfold was the number that I
powers,
saw.
People with money have discovered that there's a lot of power that rests in the judiciary. I mean, we're the third branch, so we're the weakest branch. We still have a fair amount of power, okay? And people, you know, figured out, you know, there's a certain amount of power. And so is it, you know, power abhors a vacuum, they say. And so the money, when you get this big money coming into politics, it's just a natural magnet for it to come in because people think they can influence policy by taking courts. And they've done that. It's happened in Texas, happened in Wisconsin, happened in Ohio. I mean, it's just – so, I mean, in a way it works. And the only – this is about – is it – we got to educate the people. Okay? That's what this show is about.
Yeah.
And see, is that if we're going to change, we got to energize the people to request it. If you don't like the idea that a corporation is treated as a person, you got to speak up. You got to get involved. If you don't like all this money that's coming into politics, you got to continually ask your representative because they're addicted to it. And see, this is Thomas Jefferson said. He said, "I know of no better repository for the situs for making a democracy work than the people themselves." And if you don't trust them with the vote, the answer is not to take the vote away from them, but to educate them. And so why do I come onto the stage with you, Tane?
That's the best question of the night.
You convince me that this is a chance. And what you're trying to do here with your actors or whatever is educate the people so that they become better informed citizens and make better decisions, because that's the only way a democracy can work. So, I mean, you know, it's risky, you know, but your end goal is pretty good.
Thank you. I'll try and end on a slightly happier note before we turn it over to these folks.
Well, that was
folks.
A happy note.
It is a thank you. I appreciate it.
But if you can make it happier, more power to you.
you've done a lot of work, and I mentioned this in the introduction, with the history of Minnesota and the history of the Supreme Court, and I just sort of wanted to ask, you know, why is that element of your work so important, I guess?
Well, I've always loved history, and my mother loved history. We got someone in the audience from Eden Prairie, and she wrote the history book on Eden Prairie, so I've been immersed in it. This is weighty, okay?
I'm ready.
You're ready?
I'm ready.
He said, as a lawyer, one of the most important words in your vocabulary is why. Things always happen for a reason. And history often tells you why. And so you are not good at what you do unless you can figure out why. And if you know some history, you can often say why. So, simple.
That's good. Ladies and gentlemen, on that note, can we do a big round of applause for Justice Paul Anderson? All right, if you have a question, please just raise your hand and I will come towards you with a microphone. And oh, well, it's not like you ever get a chance to ask anyone a question.
Thank you, Tane. Hi, everybody. I'd like to hear your thoughts about a proposal that is, or an event that's filling up a lot of legislative campaigns right now. Controversy comments about the new state Senate office building. What do you think, as someone who's a student of the history of that Capitol complex, what do you think Minnesotans ought to know and understand about that new building?
Well, one, it's very much linked to the restoration of our state capitol. Our state capitol is one of the four or five most symbolic state capitals in the country, built by Cass Gilbert. You know, our state capitol is kind of the alpha of his public office buildings. The Supreme Court building in Washington, D.C. is kind of the omega. And that building was falling down, and both Republicans and Democrats realized that. Actually, when the Democrats lost the House and the Senate in that session, it was the Republicans who created the Committee for the Restoration. But to restore the building in the way that it needs to be, as Cass Gilbert designed it, as the people's building, not as a Warren of Wren of Rabbit Wren of offices and whatever, so the people could go there and learn about government. And so in order to provide space for the Senate, that is that you needed an office building. Now, you can say, oh, that is really wild, profligate spending. Well, the conservative state of Wyoming just authorized $259 million to restore their capital, built about 1889. And what did they do? They understood also that in order to restore their capital the way it's supposed to be, they needed to build a four-story addition to the legislative office building in Wyoming. So it's odd to me that people will like to criticize that and make a big point about it, because it's really the fiscally responsible thing to do, and it's being built rather austerely, but yet so it could be a legacy building for the state of Minnesota. So I'm going to add one other thing. Now, I mentioned legacy, and all of us who work in government or have the privilege of doing it have to be prepared to ask what I think is a real important question. I call it the legacy question. And all of you, think about it. Think about it for your grandchildren. And then they ask you, said, you know, it was kind of a rough time back there in the early part of the 21st century. What did you do? What did you, Grandma? What did you, Grandpa, to make things better? And you need to live your life so that you're prepared to answer that question. You say, well, come here, let me tell you. And one of the things that, you know, the jobs that are provided and the innovation and the thought going into it, I think about those workers over in the building on the Capitol, and they get that question, and they'll say, Grandma, Grandpa, what did you do? And there'll be a slight pause, and said, let me show you. Let's go over to the Capitol complex, and I'll show you what I did. I mean, that's what government is about, is making things better and doing it in a fiscally responsible way. So I don't understand, you know, the people that, you know, they just think, you know, government, you're going to just try and destroy it. No, it's got that, you know, we saw it acted out here on the stage, is to try and make things better. You know, and you can disagree with the parameters of how you go about that, the policy, but please, you got to understand, that's what we're all about as a civil society, make things better.
Can I come in? I'm sorry, I'm not as well read as our delightful question here.
By the way, I answer questions too long, so I'll try to keep them shorter.
Oh, well.
I'm a little passionate about some things.
Though. What were the specific criticisms of the new Senate building? I see. I thought perhaps there was like a laser tag facility in it or something. Is there?
No. And I mean, hey, if conservative Wyoming thinks it's a similar thing as good policy, it's a dogma in search of an issue, I think.
All right. Other questions? Hands. I'm going to go up in the back, and then I'll make my way back down this way. Okay. Here we go.
Yes, Judge. On the ballot for the judgeships, do candidates with names like, say, Anderson have a better chance of gaining more votes than the Williams and the Zabars?
Unfortunately, it's not like it used to be. No, I mean, names make a difference. Gender makes a difference. We have shown, for example, on the Court of Appeals is that it tends to favor females because there's female voters tend to be more diligent in their voting. They'll work down their way and vote. I mean, it's an oddity. There was a time in the early 40s where, I mean, if you wanted to be a Supreme Court justice, it really made a difference if your last name was Gallagher. So, normally Scandinavian names work, but I'm the first Anderson that was on the court. So here's the thing, though. Oh, I'm going to offend some people on this. Yes, I am. Is that, I'm a farm kid. I grew up on a farm, but, you know, I've been the beneficiary of white male privilege. And is that we're changing, is that it's now becoming more acceptable to be seek office if you're female, if you're not Caucasian like myself. There's still a lot of racism in politics. But, hey, folks, I mean, that's the history of our country, adapting and changing. And so, you know, temporarily there might be an advantage being Anderson. It might be something different in the future. But people do vote certain prejudices and biases. So, yeah, Gallagher in the 40s, Anderson
until
in the
90s. Until that watermelon guy ruined it.
Yeah. Anyway.
Okay,
yes.
I got another one back here.
Somewhat qualified answer, yes.
You've sometimes been referred to as the literary justice, so I'm wondering if there was one book that you could ask everyone in the world to read, what would you have them read and why?
Dr. Seuss. No. No, that's Alan Page's answer. I mean, he's quoted Dr. Seuss. You know, that, you seen the movie Sophie's Choice?
Yeah,
I mean,
go from
that's
Dr.
that's
Seuss
a Sophie's Choice for me.
Oh.
I mean, ask me to choose one book. In the last 3 or 4 months, let's see, I've done, Mark Twain's autobiography. It's long, it's repetitious, but the guy is so good. There's just gems in there. I read, No Ordinary Time about Eleanor and Franklin. The Bully Pulpit. Oh, there's another one that's going to be coming out. These are just recent ones I read. Is it Unbroken? There's going to be a movie coming out December 25th. Go see the movie. Oh, it's fantastic what that guy did. And I just finished a book on Calvin Coolidge. Very intriguing time. You know, I
wanted was it a very short book? He was very...
No, it's actually somewhat long. I mean, he's... there's maybe some of his policies were ill thought out, but he's a very substantive person and is very principled. And so I found it very interesting and enjoyable. So those are just recent books. I'd be hard put to choose one. Is that your second beer? Do they allow the host to do that? Oh, I forget that. You're promoting Finnegan's.
Yes, this is
it's part of the job description.
And
I'm
hungry.
Sorry. I'm so impolitic.
Thank you. Good save of me. Other questions? There were a couple hands here in the front.
The Supreme Court is occasionally sort of the arbiter of government transparency questions and data practices questions. I'm just curious, over your time on the court, have you noticed any trends about government transparency just in seeing cases?
Slow, but generally moving forward in the right direction. We have an, oh boy, does the new technology and the internet provide all kinds of challenges. But our system thrives on being transparent and doing what we do. That's why I have to write opinions, because you have to be able to scrutinize and understand the reasons why I'm doing what I'm doing. You hold my feet to the fire. And so we need to be transparent, but we need to make sure also in this age of the internet, things that will hurt people, things that are not true, you know, get out. And so what we've done in the court, it's called, it's crazy in a way, but it's called practical obscurity. Everything that we put on the internet is something that the court has done. The court has to stand behind it and justify it. The affidavits with vitriol in them and whatever, they're still down at the court. You can go down there. But we don't make those readily available for the teenage neighbor kid who's surfing at night and wants to see what's going on in the neighbor's divorce, whatever. There's a balance. I don't know if it's a correct balance. I mean, this whole concept of privacy is so changing and it's fluid. But by the way, the legislature and the courts will always be behind where technology is. We're just always playing catch up. And it's kind of too bad that the companies wind up oftentimes as the arbitrator of what's acceptable or not because we just don't keep up the pace. But never, never give up the concept that the court has to be transparent. Hold my feet to the fire. See, I talked to Dane about being skeptical, not cynical. If you think I'm just going to judge, going to abuse my power or whatever, and no, I don't like it because you think it's the wrong thinking. But be skeptical. Don't trust me. Hold my feet to the fire. Keep me honest. Just keep pulling. And the way you can do that is that you have access to what I do.
There was a story that came out a few years ago about the United States Supreme Court talking about how that several of them didn't ever even use email. And so I'm wondering how important is it for justices to try and keep up with some of this technology stuff? Or does it, I guess the alternative argument would be the law doesn't change with the technology. The law stays the same. I'm just curious what you think about that.
Yeah, but I mean, when they're dealing with a major internet case and one of the justices says, well, the last thing I was aware of was a beeper. No. Come on. Let's get real, okay? Get into the real world. Now, with Kagan and Sotomayor and some of those coming on, they're familiar with the internet, whatever. You've got to stay somewhat contemporary. And that would be a criticism I might have of the court. I'll tell you a true story, okay? we're going to think is that, well, we should go to computers. Now, I'm the oldest guy on the court, you know. And so, well, we're going to get everybody a iPad. And we're going to learn how to, you know, use the iPad, and we're going to do everything electronically. And so I just said, okay, I'm going to be out there in the front. I'm going to take mine. Actually, I'm going to have it on the bench with me. You know what I found out? I started taking the notes on the bench with my iPad. I took better notes. They're easily editable. And I loved it. And, I mean, wow, sometimes you don't just kind of force yourself into the modern world, and it's pretty good, you know?
Has anyone introduced you to Candy Crush on your iPad?
No.
Okay, I think that there was maybe one more hand somewhere here in the front. Yes, right there.
Judge, if corporations are people...
No.
And if they are treated well... If not by the court and the law, then by the circumstances of their wealth and power, what can be done to get the people treated better?
I mean, I disagree with the line of jurisprudence that treat corporations, giving them the whole sense of personhood. I mean, now, it's a legitimate question. Some people said, well, wait a second, I'm a human being, I was born, I've got blood in my veins. So how come this corporate entity that's a creature of the state gets more personal qualities than I do? I mean, it just seems ridiculous to me, okay? But it's a reasonable legal fiction that has some basis. I just think it's getting carried too far. I mean... When you can draft a corporation to fight in Afghanistan, then I'll concede they have some aspect of a person.
To the second...
Ooh,
I'm
not on the court anymore. I can speak a little more.
So to the second half of his question, though, I mean, you've spent a lot of time talking about the good that the court can do for people's lives. And I guess the question in part is, how should the court be thinking sort of as a general philosophy about making people's lives better? If okay. that they even should be thinking that way, or should they? Some people talk about balls and strikes with courts.
We don't. I mean, that's. I mean, I found that that's what Justice Roberts said in his confirmation. Well, he doesn't only call balls and strikes. I mean, it depends upon the issue in front of him. And so that's a little bit of a misnomer. I think that judges should be traditional. In a sense, they should be cautious in their jurisprudence. Now, I'm going to touch on some people's sensitive points here, is that I will compare two things of how courts, I think the court did it right and did it wrong. Said, I think the court did it wrong in Roe versus Wade. Not the ultimate decision. I'm very protective of a woman's rights. And is it, I mean, I'm not going to tell somebody what to do. But the court in deciding that decision went so broad. All they had to do was what was before them was to decide the law as it was in Texas. That's what, and say, well, the Texas law violates the Constitution, strike it down. The rest of you states can work it out and see how you want to do it. But by making it so broad, it basically took one political group that packed up its bag and went home and said, we won, and it energized another group, and it dramatically changed the political fabric of the state of Minnesota and other states. Now, 2 years ago, we had a case before the court dealing with gay marriage. That's a very sensitive issue with many people, just like abortion was. So what did the court do? The issue was, if a state recognizes gay marriage, do federal benefits follow? And the court said, narrowly, if a state chooses to recognize gay marriage, then federal benefits follow. If they don't, no federal benefits. Okay, narrow. They left the issue to be decided by state by state. Now, have you seen what's happened? The issue is evolving in the states, and you have both blue and red states addressing this issue the way it should be addressed. When I left the court, that's a question that was asked, a question about the gay marriage issue, and I said, I am so happy and I'm so pleased that it gets decided across the street in the legislature, not by the court. See, one thing to understand about courts is we make decisions. If you don't like to make decisions, don't be a judge. I mean, that's what we do. And is that you can bring issues to us and we'll decide. But we often aren't the best place to decide. Sometimes the issues should be nurtured and filled out and discussed in the fabric and maybe decided by the governor and the legislature. And is that we're best when we respond. And so it's kind of a commentary about a court being too aggressive, where it's cautious and lets the people move and catch up. I mean, the latest decision by the Supreme Court, everybody thought they were going to be this was the issue. This was going to be the year for, you know, what the court's going to take on gay marriage. And they said, no, we'll let the state sort it out a little more for a while. It seems to be going okay. That's an okay position for a court to take in this system of ours where we divide powers and give some authority here and there. And so courts should be cautious, but when the time comes, they have to take some steps, proper steps, Brown versus Board of Education, some other, but you know, be very much aware of what you do. You know? And if we do it right, hey, people can be happy, I think.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, on that note, please, a big round of applause. For
thank you for listening. We'd like to thank our guest for agreeing to appear on the show, and also the Bryant Lake Bowl for being the host for this event. If you'd like to find out more information about upcoming shows, you can go to www.t2p2.net.